There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for another Atomic Show. My guest today is Grayson Buckingham, the CEO of DISA Technologies, a company that is doing something about an issue that has been used against the nuclear industry for forever. And that's, they're going to address the uranium mine tailings, the leftovers from mining that leaves a lot of material behind while we extract the valuable fuels for nuclear power. And in this case, from nuclear weapons. Grayson, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Rod. It's a pleasure to be on and discuss all the fascinating work we're doing here at DISA and our journey to get to this point.
Yeah, the journey is part of what we want to talk about, because I first became aware of DISA. I just looked it up. It was almost exactly 2 years ago. It was the 2nd of January in 2024 when I learned about the fact that you guys were trying to convince the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that you should not be licensed as if you were creating thousands of uranium mills. Can you tell us a little bit about the journey that you had from, I think, 2021 is when you first started your interactions with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission?
Yeah, thank you, Rod. And maybe I'll even step back a little bit to 2018 when we first started the company DISA and what we do and the problem that we're trying to address to give further context to our engagement with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which ultimately culminated in us receiving the first NRC service provider's license for abandoned uranium mines. But it started in 2018. My background, law degree, MBA, worked in the energy industry for several years, worked in the Hill, spent almost 10 years in the Army with deployments to Iraq and Kuwait. And then really started the company up with my co-founder, who's finishing up his PhD in mining engineering, John Lee, in 2018 to advance a technology called high-pressure slurry ablation, HPSA for short. And effectively what it is, it's a mechanical process. We don't use any chemicals, but we shoot rocks at each other in a way that breaks off minerals that folks care about and a value from material that what's called in the mining industry gang material, or material that doesn't really have any value. And this technology works exceptionally well on abandoned uranium mine material that's found in the Western United States. There's US EPA estimates that there are approximately 15,000 sites associated with abandoned uranium mine waste. In particular, there are documented 4,200 sites that are called defense-related uranium mines, drum sites, largely mines that were mined during the Cold War era to provide uranium for those Cold War efforts. And what had happened is, largely from the 1950s through the 1980s, the U.S. government was encouraging different companies and folks to go out and mine as much uranium as possible to beat the Soviet Union and stockpiling as much uranium. In fact, they would even incentivize folks that if they could show they had a productive mine, they would give them $100,000, for example, and would buy the uranium at higher prices. And when the market, ultimately busted in the mid-1980s, a lot of, and there were no bonding requirements back then, a lot of those sites, the waste rock that remained on site, just continued to remain on site. And so during this period when the mining activities were occurring, you'd mine for the uranium ore, you take the economic material to a uranium mill, convert that to U-308, and it would enter the supply chain. And then the uneconomic material, and then what we're discovering, still had traces of uranium in it, was just left on the surface. And so, US EPA estimates have that there's approximately 3 billion tons on average, potentially 8 billion tons of this waste rock or overburden material that, continues to sit on the surface of these thousands of sites that were mined during that Cold War period. And so, based on the success of our technology and being able to remove the uranium radium-226 and other constituents of concern from that material, and be able to potentially recycle that material, we endeavor to begin the licensing process to address this complex situation. And really, it comes down to the 1954 Atomic Energy Act, and then certain rules and regulations that were promulgated from there on how to properly license different activities when it comes to uranium. And so we initially submitted a license application to the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment in late 2020 to be able to remediate these abandoned uranium mines. And where the regulatory piece came in, if you're recovering uranium and concentrating it, even if it's for remedial activities, you need a source material license to be able to possess uranium in quantities above 0.05%. And based on the way the results that we're seeing, in almost every circumstance, we're going to have a uranium concentrate, which is basically all the stripped constituents of concern above that 0.05%. And so the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment took a look at this, and they, effectively said, based on the Atomic Energy Act and a definition called 1182 byproduct material, we believe that you would have to be licensed under what's called a milling framework versus a source material license or a remedial activity framework, which hadn't been done to date. And so a milling license, which was regulated under 10 CFR Part 40 Appendix A, takes years to obtain. It's a significant cost. For example, there's only three actively licensed uranium mills in the United States today. And those uranium mills, take uranium to yellowcake, which, is anywhere, typically 97 to 98% uranium. And, we were just taking material from, in most cases from this waste rock, 0.05 to 0.25%. And that material, if you wanted it to enter the supply chain, would still need to be taken to a mill. And we weren't using any chemicals, and we were restoring the lands and demonstrating that we could meet cleanup standards under the NRC unrestricted release criteria. And so we said, that this regulatory framework doesn't make much sense. And we were then told to apply to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for a license and for the NRC to take a look at our activities and see what bucket it falls under. And so we resubmitted a similar license application to the NRC staff directly. After taking a look at it, the NRC staff had indicated that based on the current guidance from our existing guidance from the NRC Commission, as well as interpreting the Atomic Energy Act, that we would still need to be regulated under a milling license under the 10 CFR Part 40 Appendix A, although they recognize that we were providing substantial benefit to remediating these waste rock piles, and that certain exemptions, we could apply for exemptions under a milling license framework. And for us, that approach, didn't make much sense, and didn't seem like the best approach, just given the fact how lengthy a milling license takes, how we'd have to get a license for every single site, and as of which there are thousands. We effectively argued that any type of approach to remediating these sites, whether it's through using high pressure slurry ablation or another approach, you want to get a reduction in the overall volume of waste material, and that would require concentrating those contaminants and constituents of concern, the uranium and radium 226, which would effectively trigger a milling license. And so our team had discussions with the NRC commissioners, laying out this question set, and the NRC commissioners instructed the NRC staff to put together what's called a staff requirements memo, an SRM, which outlined every way that our activities could be regulated. There were ultimately four different options
Hey,
that
let me
were
interrupt you
released.
for a second, Chris.
Yep.
You've got to give me a chance to jump in and ask a few questions.
Yeah, all
Wonderful,
right.
wonderful story, but And sometimes we gotta jump in. Now, when you had this issue with the NRC, did you get any allies? Did anybody get in, step in and say, "Hey, wait a minute, these guys are really doing something important to us. Can you help them a little bit, or try to listen to them more carefully?"
Yeah, certainly we had a lot of support. In particular, Senator Lummis and Senator Kelly were strong champions for this issue, advocating that treatment technologies need to be encouraged, that this issue of legacy waste is ultimately going to be addressed through innovation. The current methods of addressing this problem, before we came onto the scene, was either doing nothing, which is almost all has been the case entirely, burying the material on site, which doesn't address the issue of contaminants leaching into the waterway or dust particles blowing into population centers, or hauling all the material off site, which in most cases is cost prohibitive, and we don't even have the disposal capacity to take millions of tons of material to a different location, and really is just taking the problem from one location to the next. So, they were significant champions. We also presented this possible remedy to the Navajo Nation in 2019 to the Diné Uranium Remediation Advisory Commission, which led to additional studies and test work with the Navajo Nation EPA. And culminated in a EPA treatability study sponsored by US EPA and Navajo Nation EPA in 2022 and 2023. So the Navajo Nation EPA were strong supporters, as well as several other NGOs and think tanks that are focused on these types of issues, from ClearPath to Third Way, Breakthrough Institute, among several other, dozen different NGOs that helped write letters of support to the NRC on this particular issue.
Yeah, it sounds that your technology takes a look at all this rock and sand and all that contaminated waste and sees how big the pile is and said, okay, now we're going to go through this high pressure solar ablation and we're going to clean up a bunch of this material. But obviously, that means that some other portion of the material is going to have all of the material that we don't want just laying around. What's the portion between those two, the clean material versus the now concentrated material that has these minerals in it?
Yeah, no, great question. And a lot of the material is a carnotite mineralogy. So, you could effectively imagine there's a mineral patina coating that forms along this quartz mineral. And so the quartz mineral is hard on the Mohs scale hardness, it's a 7. The carnotite mineral is a 2 to 3 on the Mohs scale, so a lot softer. And almost all of your uranium, vanadium, and radium are in that. In that mineral patina coating that coats that sand. And so when we shoot those collisions at each other, we're just breaking off that mineral patina coating. So you can imagine, a bunch of tennis balls covered in mud, and shooting those tennis balls at each other, we break the mud off, but the tennis balls stay intact. And that's what's unique about our technology. We're not just breaking everything apart, we're breaking along the different minerals along their phase boundary lines. And so in running the AUM material through our system, if 100% of that material is put through, typically 80% of that material is that clean sand or a quartz type mineral that can be left on the surface that meets those cleanup goals and can be considered clean. And then 20% of that material that we break off that are in the fines has over 90% of the uranium, vanadium, and radium located in it that's taken off site. So from a waste minimization perspective, we're reducing, if you were to haul all the material off site, we're reducing that amount by typically over 80%.
So now you've got this material that used to be considered waste and was not very carefully piled up on the surface. And now 80% of it's clean, sandy material that might be valuable simply as foundations for roads and bridges and buildings and that sort of stuff. The other part has the minerals that were causing the contamination, but those minerals sound like They have some value. Are you going to be able to sell off those that concentrated mineral pile?
So all your comments are correct that that clean coarse fraction or the material that remains on site could be used for road base and other applications. Currently, for the sites that we're looking at, we plan on just returning that material to the site and restoring that site to where it was before that waste rock was left there. And then the what we call our concentrate fraction, that fraction that's typically 20% of the overall mass volume with over 90% of the uranium, vanadium, and radium that we recover in the sites that we've addressed and looked at can be upgraded to economic grades of uranium to where it can be recycled and eventually used converted into U308 to enter the nuclear fuel supply chain.
When you do this work, obviously there's work involved here. Who's going to be paying for the processes to be done?
So there's really two different cases from a business model standpoint. One is work where there's either settlement funds or remediation funds that can pay for the work. So in the case of the Navajo Nation, for example, there are 523 Superfund sites that are abandoned uranium mines. There was some recent news reporting that we received a contract from the Navajo Nation to do a cleanup on a site early next year. And from there, we're just paid to do the cleanup work. But for a lot of the vast majority of these sites, there aren't any funds that have been set aside that can be used for the cleanup. And so we're able, without even using any taxpayer dollars for those sites, to go remediate that site. And then from our the fines concentrate from all the uranium that we've removed from that waste rock, because we're able to get it to high enough grades where it's economic, we're able to take that to a uranium mill to eventually be converted to U308. And so, in those cases, we would either be paid by, a utility, or we would be paid by, the whatever entity owns that uranium mill from a purchase of that material.
You said you had some good cooperation from organizations or government entities within the Navajos Dene Nation. How are the people that live near these sites responding to your efforts, your proposed processes?
Yeah, and we've spent, as I mentioned, since 2019, having, multiple public meetings, chapter house presentations. We've presented to the Resource Development Committee for the Navajo Nation Council, presentations to the Navajo Nation EPA. At present, there's five chapter house resolutions on the Navajo Nation that indicate support for looking at our technology and evaluating it further for remediation solution. And as I mentioned, it's a continued advocacy. Our we've had a lot of great partnership with the Navajo Nation EPA in particular on advancing this as a solution. And really where the Navajo Nation EPA is most focused on at present is we had really successful results at the pilot level back in 2022 and 2023 under that EPA treatability study. And now what we're going to be doing early next year is taking a commercial size unit to do remediation of an entire area to really demonstrate that we can get the same results at scale as we did at that pilot level. And as President Nigrin of the Navajo Nation, his policy for remediating abandoned uranium mines is called safer sooner approach. And I think where the a lot of frustration lies on the Navajo Nation is, there's been billions of dollars in settlement funds for over a decade, and there's been really no meaningful cleanup to date. And I, largely the approach historically from US EPA has been just to recommend burying the material on site. And the issue with that is those caps can erode over time. The material can leach still into waterways, after those caps erode after 90 plus years. And it doesn't solve the problem. And as I mentioned earlier, hauling all that material off site in almost all cases is cost prohibitive. And so that's where a lot of folks from on the leadership level of the Navajo Nation, as well as at the chapter level, are very excited to have another potential remedy to address this issue that really has remained unresolved for since the Cold War.
The leaders of the Navajo Nation are excited. The people nearby are excited. The NRC took at least 3 or 4 years to finally accept an application. Once they got that application accepted to be a, was it a source material handler? Is that what you, how you're
Service
doing
provider's license.
that? And you submitted that service provider's application in April of 2025. How long did it take for them to review it then?
So, kind of going back in the story, in 2020, September of 2024 is when the NRC Commission unanimously voted to regulate our technology under that service provider's license, as opposed to the milling license framework that we had discussed earlier. And so once we had that guidance, and the staff had the proper guidance from that staff requirements vote, or the SECI vote, we then recompiled our license, made some edits to fall within the guidance that was promulgated in that SECI. And really, it was a great experience with the NRC staff. From submission to that license to receiving it, we did a pre-submission audit with the NRC staff beforehand, where they were able to, look at different gaps in our license to make sure that we were addressing everything that they needed to look at. And then from when we submitted it, as you mentioned, Rod, in April, they committed to a 6-month timeline, and we received the license within that 6-month timeline. We were awarded in September 30th of 2025, our license.
How did you have the patience to work through that process from, I guess you started with the state government in 2020 and finally got your license, the one that you really needed to be able to do the business you want to do and to provide the service that you believe in, and that the Navajo Nation and others affected by this believe is needed. It took you 5 years? That sounds like a lot of effort.
There certainly was a lot of effort in education and demonstrating, how we can be a major solution to this complex issue. First of a kind, anything is always a tough uphill road. And it was, as you mentioned, it certainly took a long time and a lot of belief. Our team was extremely motivated in tackling this issue. And we believe that we can offer a significant solution to an issue that's remained unaddressed for decades. And so largely, as I had mentioned earlier, through the support of leaders like Senator Lummis and Senator Kelly, as well as other groups that were passionate about getting this work done and finding a right regulatory solution, we continued to press on. Thankfully, we also had patient investors that continued to support us and saw the opportunity that we had before us. And so after doing dozens and dozens of demonstrations, from the EPA treatability study, where right now, at present, we're the only EPA validated treatment technology for abandoned uranium mine material. We also had a separate verification study from Idaho National Labs that helped us get to this point. But it is, kind of that chicken and egg problem, Rod, where we were allowed to test small quantities of material, but without the NRC license, we couldn't test commercial quantities of material. But we couldn't prove that we could do the commercial quantities without the NRC license, and so that was a very long journey, to get to this point. But ultimately, like from the, with the leadership of Commissioner Wright. Now, Chairman Wright, as well as other leaders on the NRC and members from Congress and other support groups, we were able to find a pathway forward to be able to deploy this technology to address this longstanding issue.
Yeah, those patient investors are probably pretty happy at this point, although you still need to figure out how you're going to scale your business. What is your plan? I know your system is kind of modular. Can it be manufactured and used in multiple instances at the same time? Is it a series going from one site to another? How's that going to work?
Yep. So they are mobile systems. We've already built our first commercial system that we have here in Casper, Wyoming, and we plan on bringing that system for that site on the Navajo Nation early next year. We also plan on going to a non-Navajo site next year as well for remediation. So part of our NRC license that we received, one of the conditions was for really that entire service provider's license to be unlocked, we have to go clean up a site less than 12,000 tons and demonstrate that we can meet the unrestricted release criteria under our NRC license. And once we're able to demonstrate that we can effectively clean that first site up, then that condition's met, and then we're able to apply for really any sites through a pre-mobilization notification that for sites that are on federal lands. And so, to your earlier question, it is a mobile system, so we can deploy the technology on site, perform our remediation activities, and then we can take that same system to a nearby site and continue moving that. And so, as we continue to scale up, we imagine, having a fleet of these different units that'll be moving from site to site. Some of these sites, the sites vary in size. Some sites only have 5,000 tons of material, and some sites have over 20 million tons of material. And so, for those larger sites, you would just have multiple systems. And for those smaller sites, in some cases, we'd be able to clean up in weeks.
Are you going to be manufacturing or assembling these mobile units yourself? Do some of the parts come from other suppliers? How does that work?
Yeah, so we do all the assembly ourselves. There's really three major components to our system. The first is the pump that moves the material throughout the system, and there's several well-established vendors that we procure those pumps from. The second is manufacturing the skid itself, and there's several vendors that we use that build those skids, and that's a relatively straightforward process. And then the third is all the automation that we put into our system. And we even have machine learning that's integrated into our system that looks at different variables and can make adjustments on the fly to make sure that we're treating the material as efficiently as possible. And we use what's called a PLC and VFD, and which is pretty neat because our engineers, they can control the system and different parameters within our system just on using their phone or a tablet, and we're constantly collecting that data. So those are the three major components, and then we'll package all of that together at our facilities, and then we'll be able to ship the units out from there. And then I'd add, which we haven't really gotten into on this discussion, but our technology, in addition to treating abandoned uranium mine waste material, is used for other applications for critical minerals. And so we've been able to scale up significantly in that sector, where we have a unit that runs at 50 tons per hour that's at a phosphate mine currently. We're installing a 100 ton per hour unit at a copper nickel mine in Michigan. That unit's going to be shipping here any day now. And then we've got several other units really throughout the globe on all different types of minerals, from graphite, gold, copper, potash, phosphate, etc.
Sounds like you guys are going to be pretty busy. You think you're in Casper, Wyoming? Is that where your factory is, and will all the units be assembled there?
As we continue to grow, I imagine even having a larger footprint. Our headquarters is in Casper. We have an office in outside of Denver, Colorado. Additionally, we have a presence down on the western slope of Colorado. We are starting to become, more international. We have two employees in Canada, for example. We have an employee that's going to be joining us in Dubai here in the near term, and Chile as well. So it's been fun and fast growth. 2 years ago, we were at 8 employees. This year, we started with 25 employees, and currently, we're sitting at 53 employees. So, as we continue to grow, that footprint will continue to evolve as well.
You're still at the relatively pilot stage because you still have to do that one major process. So you haven't really started building a lot of systems yet. Once you get that approved, it sounds like you're going to be really making way.
Well, and we're still at the pilot stage on the uranium front, but from critical minerals, we have hit that commercialization phase. So, which has been awesome because it's allowed us to really, hone in our core technology, to establish our supply chains, really lean into our manufacturing capabilities, develop those relationships with vendors. So on the mineral processing side of our business, using effectively the same type of technology, we've been able to gain a lot of experience and what that looks like scaling up. That positions us well to, be able to quickly scale up these systems for abandoned uranium mine applications.
That's pretty cool. Do you think you could, once you have something, say, processing phosphate waste, and you finish up with that pile, could that same system be used for other materials?
So it's a little different on the mineral processing side. We're just one unit operation out of an entire circuit. So up to 4% of global electricity is just used to break rocks apart in different mining applications. And so, in phosphate and copper and these other applications that we're in, we're competing with a ball mill, or we're in that grinding circuit that helps with size reduction. And liberation is the technical term, where you're liberating those valuable minerals from that gang material, those materials you don't care about. And so we act as a, our main value proposition in those mineral processing circuits is a reduction in overall energy. And we're increasing grades and recoveries of those minerals to improve those operators' bottom lines. So for those types of applications, it's just our core technology design that's plug and play, and then that's permanently installed. Whereas on the abandoned uranium mine front, it's a mobile system that can be deployed to various sites, and there are different ancillary pieces of equipment that we would, that we tack on to that system, so that we can do for the front to back end treatment of that waste.
The one on at a uranium site, abandoned uranium mine waste, is pretty much a standalone unit that's just taking waste and converting it into clean and less clean, potentially more valuable. It's not part of a complete process line.
Correct. Exactly. So, we do the grinding and liberation of the minerals. Like in our abandoned uranium mine systems, we also have screens, because when we break the material apart, we found that the uranium it's super fine. And so we typically cut it at around 270 mesh. To put that into perspective, that'd be the diameter of a hair follicle. And so we use the screens to cut that clean sand, which is plus 270 mesh, from the uranium, which is typically minus 270 mesh. And so we have like that additional step, for example, after we use our core technology to break those minerals apart, then we screen it. You create those two different streams by screening that material. And then we do use water in the system. It's continually recycled. And so we have a dewatering step as well, that will remove the water from the solid, so that that water can be then again recycled throughout the system as it continuously treats the material.
Does your system have any applicability in a new uranium mine or an active uranium mine that is already producing material today?
Yes, it does. The same technology can be used at, an abandoned uranium mine site as well as an active uranium mine site. With our NRC license that we recently received this September, that license is specific to abandoned uranium mines. And so if we were to look at, deploying our technology to an active uranium mine, that would fall under an entirely separate licensing framework from the NRC. So our NRC license, with that service, the service provider's license we have, is specific to inactive abandoned uranium mines at legacy sites for that specific purpose.
Okay. Now I'm going to use the word license in a different context here. Obviously, there's people out there mining uranium today, and they're being encouraged by the same kind of aggressive support for U.S. production of uranium and other critical minerals. If they have a license for a mine, would it be possible, or is it lucrative for you to think about licensing your equipment to them for them to use in their licensed mine. In other words, a intellectual property license from you to them, and then put that in their equipment or your equipment or similar equipment into a license that is approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for uranium. Is
At
that's
present,
probably a
we're
complicated question, but
no, well, and at present, we're focused strictly on remediating abandoned uranium mines and recycling, the recovered contaminants that from those particular sites. But in any application, if you reduce the amount of volume that needs to be transported off-site, and you get high recoveries, and you do that in an energy efficient way, the economics are going to be strong. We're so focused and passionate about resolving the abandoned uranium mine issue. That's our focus as a company. But yes, it could be used at active uranium mines as well, and to make those operations more economic and sustainable as well.
you know, that sounds really interesting. Again, it's great to be focused on cleaning up an old problem, but it never hurts to have a new problem to address as well with the same technology. So you would consider your secret sauce in this to be almost software rather than hardware, since it sounds like the equipment that you use is available from a number of different vendors and you assemble it together. But the software sounds pretty unique. Would that be a good interpretation?
Yes, and the software definitely allows us to, hone in our trade secrets. And, largely the secret sauce revolves around our collision chambers and our nozzles, and how we're controlling, those materials breaking apart, and the breakage mechanism. What's unique about our technology versus a ball mill, for example, and ball mills were originally introduced during the medieval ages, and that's what's used to grind material still to date, and what we're competing with in the mineral processing side. They have an external media, so they have these ceramic balls that are spun around to break this material apart. We're using the material itself and shooting material on material to break itself apart, and that's what's unique in our technology versus a ball mill or a rod mill, for example. And so, but there's a lot of, while it's relatively straightforward in that we're just shooting material at each other in slurry form, there's a whole plethora of variables that, just the slightest change in how our tank's designed, the angles of our nozzles, the outlets of our nozzles, the type of material we're using in our nozzles or our chamber, all have an impact on how effectively and efficiently we break those materials apart. And so that's really the core of our IP and what we use in the software we use to augment our learnings and to get to those solutions quicker. There's a lot of, none of this material that we're treating, either mineral processing or abandoned uranium mine waste, is homogeneous. And so there's a lot of variability in the type of material we put through our system. And so by being able to, leverage machine learning and software, we're able to make adjustments, automatically within our system that can lead to better outcomes and results.
With some of the sites that you're going to be going to, I imagine they're pretty dry, pretty remote. How do you provide the? I know you said the water is a closed system, but you got to bring some water to site. And where's the power come from for your pumps and the rest of your equipment?
Yeah, so for power, if there's not line power easily accessible, we would use a generator. A lot of these sites, it's funny, we actually identify because you can find, line power going out to the site when it was a larger mine. But for these smaller sites, we would use a generator to provide power. The throughput of our units for abandoned uranium mine sites are 50 tons an hour to 100 tons an hour. Once we get larger than 100 tons, it's too difficult to transport those systems from site to site. And so for a larger site, we would have multiple systems if we wanted to clean that, if the objective was to clean that site up quicker. And then for the water component, we do recycle the water throughout the process. We lose about, 10 to 15% of the water in the process during that dewatering stage, although, that works out quite well because, that's about the moisture levels that you want for compaction when you return that coarse material back to the surface. And then, so we do require a little bit of makeup water every day. In practice, that translates to about 1 to 2 water trucks that would need to be taken to site every day.
Do you have any feel for why there are so many sites? It sounds like an awful lot of uranium mines.
There's certainly a lot, and it's been amazing just traveling to these different sites. And a lot of times, if you didn't know what you were looking for, you would just think it's another pile of rocks that you'd drive by. During the heyday of the Cold War, there were a lot of smaller operations that were trying to find a site and go after it. And as I mentioned, the Atomic Energy Commission, now the Department of Energy, was very encouraging for the U.S. to get as many sites and mines online. A lot of that has to do with the geology of these areas, and the different pockets of uranium, and then the different volatility of prices over time of like a lot of the smaller sites that we've seen were mined in the 50s, or late 40s, and then the larger sites come online later in like the 70s and 80s. It's been fascinating to learn about it, because where the U.S. government's done a good job is, there's a database that shows where that 15,000 site estimate of sites associated with abandoned uranium mine waste. That the EPA has a database, and other states and USGS as well have databases. But what that database doesn't show is the size of the sites or the levels of contamination in each site. So, we have an internal team here at DISA that's taking those extra steps, and so we have our own proprietary ArcGIS database. We have 1,000 sites in there right now, and it's really neat. We're able to go back in time and see what the site looked like, what it looks like today through satellite imagery, and then looking at photos from the 60s, for example, and 70s, and you can see when that mining activity occurred. So there's a lot of initial desktop review that we do to say, okay, EPA has identified a location here. Let's go see if via the satellite imagery if this actually looks like an abandoned uranium mine site. And there's several different indicators that we look at. And then once we have confidence that it is actually waste rock from an abandoned uranium mine site, we'll send a team that'll go do gamma walkover scans. And in a lot of cases, those readings will be significantly higher than background. And then we have the confidence that it is indeed waste rock and is a legacy from historic uranium mining. And then we'll proceed to do further investigation of that site.
When you have a system operating, do you need any operators on site? You said you can do some control via phones and pads, but do they have to have somebody there watching the gauges and making sure the nozzles are properly adjusted?
So we endeavor to automate as much as we possibly can with our system, although it does require operators to be on site. For example, you need one individual that's running a loader that's picking up the waste rock and putting it into our system. We'll have a radiation safety technician on site, and as well as folks just to make manual adjustments as needed to the system. But as we've continued to advance the technology over the years, we have pneumatic valves and automatic sensors. So a lot of that is done without manual interference. But as a practice, and just given the amount of material that's being loaded and unloaded, we do our field crews are we anticipate, as we start these deployments next year, around four folks that are operating the equipment and managing the system as it does its treatment activities.
Very good. All right, Grayson, I am going to offer you the opportunity to tell us anything that you want to talk about that didn't ask you. It sounds like you guys have got a kind of a winner going here.
No, yeah, thanks for the opportunity, and thanks for having me on, Rod. I think we're just extremely grateful that we found a regulatory path forward to address this longstanding issue. As I've mentioned earlier, there's thousands and thousands of sites, and there really has not been a lot of meaningful work done to address these legacy sites. And so we're excited to have a technology that can play a major role in not only remediating these sites, but also recovering uranium that can be ultimately recycled and help support this nuclear renaissance that we're seeing occur, not only in the United States, but throughout the globe.
Yeah, I'm going to finish with or make one more comment, and then you can respond if you would like to my audience. One of the reasons I was been talking to Grayson and following the DISA story is it intrigued me to see the kind of challenge they were having getting the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to interpret their own rules. It was really a matter of understanding what the rules said and what they meant in order to allow this beneficial cleanup technology to be approved. And it took the NRC a long time, years, to make the decisions necessary. And in some cases, there was some staff work done and sitting on commissioners' desks for over a year. And the chairman of the commission didn't do anything to really push it along. But times have changed. Once the NRC decided what the right way to go was, the modern NRC, the NRC being led today by the commissioners that are there, got things going, and the review took about 6 months. So once they have made the decision and have read their rules and interpreted them a logical way, they can move pretty quick. And the last thing is, Grayson, like many people in the nuclear industry, didn't really want to tell this story until after the decisions were made. I think it's kind of a problem for the fact that the nuclear folks tend to not want to upset the NRC just so they could get the right decision made. What do you say, Grayson? Is that an unfair thing to say?
I would just comment, Rod. I think with Chairman Wright and his leadership and the commissioners in place, as the last year has been amazing working with the NRC, and complex issues take a lot of time. As an entrepreneur, it can feel like a lifetime. And I think when you're looking at a law that was passed in 1954 didn't really intend for technologies like ours, or couldn't foresee the different technologies that would come about, and the different solutions that innovation can bring. And so I think with just a flexible approach, and that's why we're very appreciative of our license that was issued in September. It almost felt like over the years we were trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. But the way that the commissioners, the NRC staff provided different options, and the way the commission voted unanimously to regulate our technology, now allows us to go be able to address this longstanding issue.
Congratulations. I applaud your patience and applaud whoever your investors are, because you didn't really mention them, but applaud them for having had the patience to keep supporting you. This is one of the things that is helpful in an environment like the US has, where we've got the ability for people to make investments, don't always have to wait for appropriations or get taxpayer assistance to wait things out. We do have people that can say, okay, it's a risk, but we're willing to accept it because there's a potential reward here at the end. Grayson, thank you for your patience and take care.
Yeah, thank you, Ron. Have a great rest of your year.
Yep. And there won't be very much of the year left, but that's okay. I will work to make sure it's a great one.
Yep.
Bye.
All right.
At the time this show was released, Nucleation Capital, the sponsor of the Atomic Show, had no financial interest in DISA Technologies. We like the way they're thinking and the way they're building a business to solve a long-standing problem. Hope you enjoyed the show.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.